then telling herself in reassurance, "We're moving. We're still moving." The track of the Kansas Western was worse than she had expected, she thought, listening to the wheels. The train was now carrying her hundreds of miles away from Utah. She had felt a desperate desire to get off the train on the main line, abandon all the problems of Taggart Transcontinental, find an airplane and fly straight to Quentin Daniels. It had taken a cheerless effort of will to remain in her car. She lay in the darkness listening to the wheels, thinking that only Daniels and his motor still remained like a point of fire ahead, pulling her forward. Of what use would the motor now be to her? She had no answer. Why did she feel so certain of the desperate need to hurry? She had no answer. To reach him in time was the only ultimatum left in her mind. She held on to it, asking no questions. Wordlessly, she knew the real answer. The motor was needed not to move trains, but to keep her moving. She could not hear the beat of the fourth Knox any longer and the jumbled screeching of metal. She could not hear the steps of the enemy she was racing. Only the hopeless stampede of panic. "I'll get there in time," she thought. "I'll get there first. I'll save the motor." "There's one motor. He's not going to stop," she thought. "He's not going to stop. He's not going to stop. He's not going to stop," she thought, awakening with a jolt, jerking her head off the pillow. The wheels had stopped. For a moment she remained still, trying to grasp the peculiar stillness around her. It felt like the impossible attempt to create a sensory image of non-existence. There were no attributes of reality to perceive, nothing but their absence. No sound, as if she were alone on the train. No motion, as if this were not a train, but a room in a building. No light, as if this were neither train nor room, but space without objects. No sign of violence or physical disaster, as if this were the state where disaster is no longer possible. In the moment when she grasped the nature of the stillness, her body sprang upright with a single curve of motion, immediate and violent, like a cry of rebellion. The loud screech of the window shade went like a knife cut through the silence, as she threw the shade upward. There was nothing outside but anonymous stretches of prairie. A strong wind was breaking the clouds, and a shaft of moonlight fell through, but it fell upon plains that seemed as dead as those from which it came. The sweep of her hand pressed the light switch and the bell to summon the porter. The electric light came on and brought her back to a rational world. She glanced at her watch. It was a few minutes past midnight. She looked out of the rear window. The track went off in a straight line, and at the prescribed distance she saw the red lanterns left on the ground, placed conscientiously to protect the rear of the train. The sight seemed reassuring. She pressed the porter's bell once more. She waited. She went to the vestibule, unlocked the door, and leaned out to look down the line of the train. A few windows were lighted in the long, tapering band of steel, but she saw no figures, no sign of human activity. She slammed the door, came back, and started to dress, her movements suddenly calm and swift. No one came to answer her bell. When she hastened across to the next car, she felt no fear, no uncertainty, no despair, nothing but the urgency of action. There was no porter in the cubbyhole of the next car, no porter in the car beyond. She hurried down the narrow passageways, meeting no one. But a few compartment doors were open. The passengers sat inside, dressed or half-dressed, silently as if waiting. They watched her rush by with oddly furtive glances, as if they knew what she was after, as if they had expected someone to come and to face what they had not faced. She went on, running down the spinal cord of a dead train, noting the peculiar combination of lighted compartments, open doors, and empty passages. No one had ventured to step out. No one had wanted to ask the first question. She ran through the train's only coach, where some passengers slept in contorted poses of exhaustion, while others, awake and still, sat hunched, like animals waiting for a blow, making no move to avert it. In the vestibule of the coach, she stopped. She saw a man who had unlocked the door and was leaning out, looking inquiringly ahead through the darkness, ready to step off. He turned at the sound of her approach. She recognized his face. It was Owen Kellogg, the man who had rejected the future she had once offered him. "Kellogg," she gasped, the sound of laughter in her voice like a cry of relief at the sudden sight of a man in a desert. "Hello, Miss Taggart," he answered, with an astonished smile that held a touch of incredulous pleasure and of wistfulness. "I didn't know you were aboard." "Come on," she ordered, as if he were still an employee of the railroad. "I think we're on a frozen train." "We are," he said, and followed her with prompt, disciplined obedience. No explanations were necessary. It was as if, in unspoken understanding, they were answering a call to duty, and it seemed natural that of the hundreds aboard, it was the two of them who should be partners in danger. "Any idea how long we've been standing?" she asked, as they hurried on through the next car. "Nope," he said. "We were standing when I woke up." They went the length of the train, finding no porters, no waiters in the diner, no brakeman, no conductor. They glanced at each other once in a while, but kept silent. They knew the stories of abandoned trains, of the crews that vanished in sudden bursts of rebellion against serfdom. They got off at the end of the train, with no motion around them save the wind on their faces, and they climbed swiftly aboard the engine. The engine's headlight was on, stretching like an accusing arm into the void of the night. The engine's cab was empty. Her cry of desperate triumph broke out in answer to the shock of the sight. "Good for them. They're human beings." She stopped, aghast, as at the cry of a stranger. She noticed that Kellogg stood watching her curiously, with the faint hint of a smile. It was an old steam engine, the best that the railroad had been able to provide for the Comet. The fire was banked in the grates, the steam gauge was low, and in the great windshield before them the headlight fell upon a band of ties that should have been running to meet them, but lay still instead, like a ladder's steps, counted, numbered, and ended. She reached for the log book and looked at the names of the train's last crew. The engineer had been Pat Logan. Her head dropped slowly, and she closed her eyes. She thought of the first run on a green-blue track that must have been in Pat Logan's mind, as it was now in hers, through the silent hours of his last run on any rail. "Miss Taggart," said Owen Kellogg softly. She jerked her head up. "Yes," she said. "Yes. Well." Her voice had no color, except the metallic tinge of decision. "We'll have to get to a phone and call for another crew." She glanced at her watch. "At the rate we were running, I think we must be about 80 miles from the Oklahoma state line. I believe Bradshaw is this road's nearest division point to call. We're somewhere within 30 miles of it." "Are there any Taggart trains following us?" "The next one is number 253, the Transcontinental Freight. But it won't get here till about 7 a.m. if it's running on time, which I doubt." "Only one freight in 7 hours?" He said it involuntarily, with a note of outraged loyalty to the great railroad he had once been proud to serve. Her mouth moved in the brief snap of a smile. "Our transcontinental traffic is not what it was in your day." He nodded slowly. "I don't suppose there are any Kansas Western trains coming tonight either. I can't remember offhand, but I think not." He glanced at the poles by the side of the track. "I hope that the Kansas Western people have kept their phones in order." "You mean that the chances are they haven't, if we judge by the state of their track. But we'll have to try it." "Yes." She turned to go, but stopped. She knew it was useless to comment, but the words came out involuntarily. "You know," she said, "it's those lanterns our men put behind the train to protect us that's the hardest thing to take. They felt more concern for human lives than their country had shown for theirs." His swift glance at her was like a shot of deliberate emphasis. Then he answered gravely, "Yes, Miss Taggart." Climbing down the ladder on the side of the engine, they saw a cluster of passengers gathered by the track, and more figures emerging from the train to join them. By some special instinct of their own, the men who had sat waiting knew that someone had taken charge. Someone had assumed the responsibility, and it was now safe to show signs of life. They all looked at her with an air of inquiring expectation as she approached. The unnatural pallor of the moonlight seemed to dissolve the differences of their faces and to stress the quality they all had in common, a look of cautious appraisal, part fear, part plea, part impertinence held in abeyance. "Is there anyone here who wishes to be spokesman for the passengers?" she asked. They looked at one another. There was no answer. "Very well," she said. "You don't have to speak. I'm Dagny Taggart, the operating vice president of this railroad, and—" There was a rustle of response from the group, half movement, half whisper, resembling relief. "And I'll do the speaking. We're on a train that has been abandoned by its crew. There was no physical accident. The engine is intact, but there is no one to run it. This is what the newspapers call a frozen train. You all know what it means, and you know the reasons. Perhaps you knew the reasons long before they were discovered by the men who deserted you tonight. The law forbade them to desert, but this will not help you now." A woman shrieked suddenly with the demanding petulance of hysteria. "What are we going to do?" Dagny paused to look at her. The woman was pushing forward to squeeze herself into the group, to place some human bodies between herself and the sight of the great vacuum, the planes stretching off and dissolving into moonlight, the dead phosphorescence of impotent borrowed energy. The woman had a coat thrown over a nightgown. The coat was slipping open, and her stomach protruded under the gown's thin cloth, with that loose obscenity of manner which assumes all human self-revelation to be ugliness and makes no effort to conceal it. For a moment, Dagny regretted the necessity to continue. "I shall go down the track to a telephone," she continued, her voice clear and as cold as the moonlight. "There are emergency telephones at intervals of 5 miles along the right-of-way. I shall call for another crew to be sent here. This will take some time. You will please stay aboard and maintain such order as you are capable of maintaining."
"What about the gangs of raiders?"
asked another woman's nervous voice. "That's true," said Dagny. "I'd better have someone to accompany me. Who wishes to go?" She had misunderstood the woman's motive. There was no answer. There were no glances directed at her or at one another. There were no eyes, only moist ovals glistening in the moonlight. There they were, she thought, the men of the new age, the demanders and recipients of self-sacrifice. She was struck by a quality of anger in their silence, an anger saying that she was supposed to spare them moments such as this, and with a feeling of cruelty new to her. She remained silent by conscious intention. She noticed that Owen Kellogg, too, was waiting. But he was not watching the passengers. He was watching her face. When he became certain that there would be no answer from the crowd, he said quietly, "I'll go with you, of course, Miss Taggart." "Thank you."
"What about us?" snapped the nervous woman.
Dagny turned to her, answering in the formal, inflectionless monotone of a business executive. "There have been no cases of raider gang attacks upon frozen trains, unfortunately."
"Just where are we?"
asked a bulky man with too expensive an overcoat and too flabby a face. His voice had a tone intended for servants, by a man unfit to employ them.
"In what part of what state?"
"I don't know," she answered.
"How long will we be kept here?"
asked another, in the tone of a creditor who is imposed upon by a debtor. "I don't know."
"When will we get to San Francisco?"
asked a third, in the manner of a sheriff addressing a suspect.
"I don't know."
The demanding resentment was breaking loose in small crackling puffs, like chestnuts popping open in the dark oven of the mines, who now felt certain that they were taken care of and safe.
"This is perfectly outrageous," yelled a woman, springing forward, throwing her words at Dagny's face. "You have no right to let this happen. I don't intend to be kept waiting in the middle of nowhere. I expect transportation."
"Keep your mouth shut," said Dagny, "or I'll lock the train doors and leave you where you are."
"You can't do that. You're a common carrier. You have no right to discriminate against me. I'll report it to the Unification Board."
"If I give you a train to get you within sight or hearing of your board?" said Dagny, turning away. She saw Kellogg looking at her, his glance like a line drawn under her words, underscoring them for her own attention. "Get a flashlight somewhere," she said, "while I go to get my handbag. Then we'll start." When they started out on their way to the track phone, walking past the silent line of cars, they saw another figure descending from the train and hurrying to meet them. She recognized the tramp.
"Trouble, ma'am?"
he asked, stopping.
"The crew is deserted."
"Oh.
What's to be done?"
"I'm going to a phone to call the division point."
"You can't go alone, ma'am.
Not these days. I'd better go with you." She smiled. Thanks, but I'll be all right. Mr. Kellogg here is going with me. Say, what's your name?
Jeff Allen, ma'am.
Listen, Allen, have you ever worked for a railroad?
No, ma'am.
Well, you're working for one now. You're a deputy conductor and proxy vice president in charge of operation. Your job is to take charge of this train in my absence, to preserve order, and to keep the cattle from stampeding. Tell them that I appointed you. You don't need any proof. They'll obey anybody who expects obedience.
Yes, ma'am, he answered firmly,
with a look of understanding. She remembered that money inside a man's pocket had the power to turn into confidence inside his mind. She took a $100 bill from her bag and slipped it into his hand. An advance on wages, she said.
Yes, ma'am.
She had started off when he called after her.
Miss Taggart.
She turned.
Yes?
Thank you, he said.
She smiled, half raised her hand in a parting salute, and walked on.
Who is that? Asked Kellogg.
A tramp who was caught stealing a ride.
He'll do the job, I think.
He will. They walked silently past the engine and on in the direction of its headlight. At first, stepping from tie to tie with the violent light beating against them from behind, they still felt as if they were at home in the normal realm of a railroad. Then she found herself watching the light on the ties under her feet, watching it ebb slowly, trying to hold it, to keep seeing its fading glow until she knew that the hint of a glow on the wood was no longer anything but moonlight. She could not prevent the shudder that made her turn to look back. The headlight still hung behind them like the liquid silver globe of a planet, deceptively close, but belonging to another orbit and another system. Owen Kellogg walked silently beside her, and she felt certain that they knew each other's thoughts. He couldn't have.
Oh, God, he couldn't, she said suddenly, not realizing that she had switched to words.
Who?
Nathaniel Taggart.
He couldn't have worked with people like those passengers. He couldn't have run trains for them. He couldn't have employed them. He couldn't have used them at all, neither as customers nor as workers.
Kellogg smiled. You mean that he couldn't have grown rich by exploiting them, Miss Taggart?
She nodded. They, she said, and he heard the faint trembling of her voice, which was love and pain and indignation. They've said for years that he rose by thwarting the ability of others, by leaving them no chance, and that human incompetence was to his selfish interest. But it wasn't obedience that he required of people.
Miss Taggart, he said, with an odd note of sternness in his voice, just remember that he represented a code of existence which, for a brief span in all human history, drove slavery out of the civilized world. Remember it when you feel baffled by the nature of his enemies.
Have you ever heard of a woman named Ivy Starnes?
Oh, yes.
I keep thinking that this was what she would have enjoyed, the spectacle of those passengers tonight. This was what she's after. But we can't live with it, you and I, can we? No one can live with it. It's not possible to live with it.
What makes you think that Ivy Starnes' purpose is life?
Somewhere on the edge of her mind, like the wisps she saw floating on the edges of the prairie, neither quite rays, nor fog, nor cloud, she felt some shape which she could not grasp, half suggested and demanding to be grasped. She did not speak, and like the links of a chain unrolling through their silence, the rhythm of their steps went on, spaced to the ties, scored by the dry, swift beat of heels on wood. She had not had time to be aware of him, except as of a providential comrade in competence. Now she glanced at him with conscious attention. His face had the clear, hard look she remembered having liked in the past, but the face had grown calmer, as if more serenely at peace. His clothes were threadbare. He wore an old leather jacket, and even in the darkness she could distinguish the scuffed blotches streaking across the leather. What have you been doing since you left Taggart Transcontinental? She asked.
Oh, many things.
Where are you working now?
On special assignments, more or less.
Of what kind?
Of every kind.
You're not working for a railroad?
No. the sharp brevity of the sound, seemed to expand it into an eloquent statement. She knew that he knew her motive.
Kellogg, if I told you that I don't have a single first-rate man left on the Taggart system, if I offered you any job, any terms, any money you cared to name, would you come back to us?
No.
You were shocked by our loss of traffic. I don't think you have any idea of what our loss of men has done to us. I can't tell you the sort of agony I went through 3 days ago trying to find somebody able to build 5 miles of temporary track. I have 50 miles to build through the Rockies. I see no way to do it. But it has to be done. I've combed the country for men. There aren't any. And then to run into you suddenly, to find you here in a day coach, when I'd give half the system for one employee like you. Do you understand why I can't let you go? Choose anything you wish. Want to be general manager of a region? Or assistant operating vice president?
No.
You're still working for a living, aren't you?
Yes.
You don't seem to be making very much.
I'm making enough for my needs, and for nobody else's.
Why are you willing to work for anyone but Taggart Transcontinental?
Because you wouldn't give me the kind of job I'd want.
I?
She stopped still.
Good God, Kellogg, haven't you understood? I'd give you any job you name.
All right. Track walker.
What?
Section hand. Engine wiper.
He smiled at the look on her face.
No? You see, I said you wouldn't.
Do you mean that you'd take a day laborer's job?
Any time you offered it.
But nothing better?
That's right, nothing better.
Don't you understand that I have too many men who are able to do those jobs, but nothing better?
I understand it, Miss Taggart.
Do you? What I need is your
mind, Miss Taggart. My mind is not on the market any longer.
She stood looking at him, her face growing harder.
You're one of them, aren't you? She said at last.
Of whom?
She did not answer, shrugged, and went on.
Miss Taggart, he asked, how long will you remain willing to be a common carrier? I won't surrender the world to the creature you're quoting.
The answer you gave her was much more realistic.
The chain of their steps had stretched through many silent minutes before she asked, why did you stand by me tonight? Why were you willing to help me?
He answered easily, almost gaily. Because there isn't a passenger on that train who needs to get where he's going more urgently than I do. If the train can be started, none will profit more than I. But when I need something, I don't sit and expect transportation like that creature of yours.
You don't? And what if all trains stopped running?
Then I wouldn't count on making a crucial journey by train.
Where are you going?
West.
On a special assignment?
No, for a month's vacation with some friends.
A vacation?
And it's that important to you?
More important than anything on earth.
They had walked 2 miles when they came to the small gray box on a post by the trackside, which was the emergency telephone. The box hung sidewise, beaten by storms. She jerked it open. The telephone was there, a familiar, reassuring object, glinting in the beam of Kellogg's flashlight. But she knew the moment she pressed the receiver to her ear, and he knew when he saw her finger tapping sharply against the hook, that the telephone was dead. She handed the receiver to him without a word. She held the flashlight while he went swiftly over the instrument, then tore it off the wall and studied the wires. "The wire's okay," he said. "The current's on. It's this particular instrument that's out of order. There's a chance that the next one might be working." He added, "The next one is 5 miles away."
"Let's go," she said.
Far behind them, the engine's headlight was still visible. Not a planet any longer, but a small star winking through mists of distance. Ahead of them, the rail went off into bluish space, with nothing to mark its end. She realized how often she had glanced back at that headlight. So long as it remained in sight, she had felt as if a lifeline were holding them anchored safely. Now they had to break it. And dive off this planet, she thought. She noticed that Kellogg, too, stood looking back at the headlight. They glanced at each other, but said nothing. The crunch of a pebble under her shoe sole burst like a firecracker in the silence. With a coldly intentional movement, he kicked the telephone instrument and sent it rolling into a ditch. The violence of the noise shattered the vacuum.
"God damn him," he said evenly, not raising his voice, with a loathing past any display of emotion. He probably didn't feel like attending to his job, and since he needed his paycheck, nobody had the right to ask that he keep the phones in order.
"Come on," she said. "We can rest if you feel tired, Miss Taggart."
"I'm all right. We have no time to feel tired."
"That's our great error, Miss Taggart. We ought to take the time someday."
She gave a brief chuckle. She stepped onto a tie of the track, stressing the step as her answer, and they went on. It was hard walking on ties, but when they tried to walk along the track side, they found that it was harder. The soil, half sand, half dust, sank under their heels, like the soft, unresisting spread of some substance that was neither liquid nor solid. They went back to walking from tie to tie. It was almost like stepping from log to log in the midst of a river. She thought of what an enormous distance 5 miles had suddenly become, and that a division point 30 miles away was now unattainable, after an era of railroads built by men who thought in thousands of transcontinental miles. That net of rails and light, spreading from ocean to ocean, hung on the snap of a wire, on a broken connection inside a rusty phone. No, she thought, on something much more powerful and much more delicate. It hung on the connections in the minds of the men who knew that the existence of a wire, of a train, of a job, of themselves and their actions was an absolute not to be escaped. When such minds were gone, a 2,000-ton train was left at the mercy of the muscles of her legs. Tired, she thought. Even the strain of walking was of value, a small piece of reality in the stillness around them. The sensation of effort was a specific experience. It was pain, and could be nothing else. In the midst of a space which was neither light nor dark, a soil which neither gave nor resisted, a fog which neither moved nor hung still. Their strain was the only evidence of their motion. Nothing changed in the emptiness around them, nothing took form to mark their progress. She had always wondered, in incredulous contempt, about the sects that preached the annihilation of the universe as the ideal to be attained. There, she thought, was their world, and the content of their minds made real. When the green light of a signal appeared by the track, it gave them a point to reach and pass. But, incongruous in the midst of the floating dissolution, it brought them no sense of relief. It seemed to come from a long-since-extinguished world, like those stars whose light remains after they are gone. The green circle glowed in space, announcing a clear track, inviting motion, where there was nothing to move. Who was that philosopher, she thought, who preached that motion exists without any moving entities? This was his world, too. She found herself pushing forward with increasing effort, as if against some resistance that was not pressure but suction. Glancing at Kellogg, she saw that he too was walking like a man braced against a storm. She felt as if the two of them were the sole survivors of reality, she thought. Two lonely figures fighting, not through a storm, but worse, through non-existence. It was Kellogg who glanced back after a while, and she followed his glance. There was no headlight behind them. They did not stop. Looking straight ahead, he reached absently into his pocket. She felt certain that the movement was involuntary. He produced a package of cigarettes and extended it to her. She was about to take a cigarette. Then suddenly she seized his wrist and tore the package out of his hand. It was a plain white package that bore as single imprint the sign of the dollar. "Give me the flashlight," she ordered, stopping. He stopped obediently and sent the beam of the flashlight at the package in her hands. She caught a glimpse of his face. He looked a little astonished and very amused. There was no printing on the package, no trade name, no address, only the dollar sign stamped in gold. The cigarettes bore the same sign. "Where did you get this?" she asked. He was smiling. "If you know enough to ask that, Miss Taggart, you should know that I won't answer. I know that this stands for something." "The dollar sign? For a great deal. It stands on the vest of every fat pig-like figure in every cartoon, for the purpose of denoting a crook, a grafter, a scoundrel, as the one surefire brand of evil.
It stands as the money of a free country, for achievement, for success, for ability, for man's creative power. And precisely for these reasons, it is used as a brand of infamy. It stands stamped on the forehead of a man like Hank Reardon as a mark of damnation. Incidentally,